Welcome to Cabronas y Chingonas, a podcast where we talk about queer and Latinx topics, such as...
Powerpuff Girls, hello, Buttercup.
Gayest person on the show.
If you liked her, you're now gay. Congratulations on that. And then there was also...
Cerebellum, who was pretty, you know, busty, very like a novellas type character, you know? So she had that kind of like...
High femme.
Yeah.
Sofia Vergara. Show them Mariah Carey outline, you know? We see it, girl.
Definitely. Yeah. Not just the villains were gay, guys. Not just the villains.
Oh, God. Mojo Jojo. And then the other one, him.
Him. That was such a cool character.
God.
It made him a villain.
Yeah, but he was so creepy. It made it work for, like, that is, like, in very, I mean, yeah, it's bad, but it gave you, like, a sense of fear in a story that needs that. You know, a lot of villains aren't that kind of, like, creepy and crazy. Like, that could just give everyone in the room that feeling, you know? So I always like that. But you're right. It sucks that the queer character was the villain.
Yeah, if we had made it canon with Buttercup, it wouldn't be such a problem.
It wouldn't be a problematic thing. Just have Buttercup out here fighting.
Right.
It's fine, whatever. What's poppin', chingona? What's goody?
Coming at you live from Molcajete Dominguero Studios here. Hey. Thanks again to Luis.
Shout out, Luis. We love you.
You're the best. And we're very fortunate today to be joined by Henry Barajas.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Hey.
Hey.
This felt very NPR. I was like, yo, I'm on Terry Gross. Like, am I Terry Gross? This is great.
That'd be rad. She's so amazing.
Welcome to Smooth Jazz 105.3. Dope. Yeah. Thank you for coming all the way here. We're just lucky enough that, like, I recently did an article covering your Kickstarter for your comic.
Much appreciated. Thank you.
And I thank you for doing the comic because it sounds amazing, and I got to read a little bit about it, which is really
great.
Oh,
yeah. Sorry, it was so late.
No, you're good.
We did this Kickstarter to fund my comic about my great-grandfather, Ramon Jauregui. I called him Tata Rambo growing up. So when I was a kid, my family would say that he was such a good guy. He did all these things for the Pascuayaki tribe, and they just didn't really go beyond that. And I always grew up knowing he had some sort of impact, but I didn't realize how great that impact was. And he was also very poor. He was very sick. He smoked a lot, so he had emphysema. So it was always like, I always felt bad for him. And then I decided, I had lost my job as an editor at an alt weekly, and I was freelancing. I wasn't really doing anything that I was excited about, so I wanted to stop interviewing people and kind of look inwards. So I went and tried to figure out what my great-grandfather did, and it was a three-year-long process of just of answering questions, and then each answer inspired another question and another just open. I kept falling into different rabbit holes, like in Alice in Wonderland. Like, I just kept getting bigger and smaller, and I had to stop and just publish with what I had. So I work at this comic book company called Top Cow Productions, and my boss, Matt Hawkins, liked what I was doing and said he would help me if I worked with Jay Gonzo. And I've known Jay Gonzo for a long time, so it was like, oh, that guy's really good, and maybe he's open to him. Hopefully he would have the time to work with me. And he was, you know, in a position to do it, and I was very honored. So I contacted him. He got on board. I gave him the script, and then I hired my friend Claire Napier. She's out in London. And I needed somebody like her because Gonzo and I are both, you know, Latinx, and I'm from Arizona. He's from California, but he lives in Arizona. So we both had this duty to do something good for our people, you know, and just kind of honor not only our history, but ourselves. So I wanted someone who just could completely remove themselves from that. And she's also a Eisner nominated editor for Women Who Write About Comics.
Wow.
And that whole website got an Eisner nomination. And unfortunately, they didn't win, but, you know, that competition was so fierce that year. So I wanted to tap into someone who doesn't care about what you think. You know, she just puts whatever she wants on online, and she really has an opinion that I respect. So she was kind enough to look at what I had and felt that this was something that she wanted to attach herself to. So we took what we had, 30 pages, to do a first issue. This whole thing is supposed to be digital first, but in comics, you make money with the printed artifact. So I printed, so we're printing our first issue, which is going to be about 36 pages long, 30 pages of sequential art, and then 6 pages of back matter. We're finalizing the back matter for the digital, which is going to be 60 pages. It's going to be all of my research. It's the director's cut, which is what you have. So the print edition will have the more curated art, and I mean, like, you know, documents from my research. And then after, and then hopefully within San Diego Comic-Con July, we're going to have a printed edition for the entire story with image, and that's going to be printed through Top Cow Productions and Image Comics.
Which, awesome, by the way, for like Top Cow Productions is coming out with some amazing work. I've had the privilege of like covering quite a few of their comics and stuff like that. They're so good.
Yeah,
so
we're underrated. Best known now for a series called Sunstone. Mm-hmm. It's about a lesbian couple that meet online and they practice BDSM and they fall in love. It's a love story that also addresses the fetish scene, you know, the BDSM lifestyle. Mm-hmm. A lot of the times it's like a trope or it's kind of made fun of, mm-hmm, and with 50 Shades of Grey, it's shined a, like, a very commercial light on it, and a lot of people either jive with it or don't, and especially people within the community aren't very keen on it. But Sunstone is one of the best-selling eroticas on Amazon right now. It's sold thousands of copies, and it's funny because Top Cow started off as like a cheesecake comic factory where they were making like Witchblade comics that were, you know, that had very beautiful art and very beautiful women, but they were like, you know, the Barbie thin waists with the busty chicks, and now Top Cow's pivoted to a very sex positive comics publisher, which is, you know, really cool to be a part of.
That's lit.
Yeah, and Matt Hawkins himself, like, I've covered some of his work, and he's done a great job of like including POC characters quite a bit, and like bigger, you know, I've seen like big girls in his comics.
Think Tank, yeah, there was a
Think Tank. That's one of the ones. Yeah. It's a great one, and I mean, it does have your typical douchey white character at the helm, but it's a really good comic. Oh, wow. It's totally great.
Real diversity concept. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he also hires diverse. I mean, I'm, you know, a cis Mexican, you know, Hispanic kid from Tucson, Arizona. My boss, she's a Puerto Rican from Yonkers. You know, all our artists are from around the world. You know, Stepan Sejic, who created Sunstone, lives in Croatia. I mean, it's just it's cool to be a part of a company that values diversity, not only in content but also in comics. So
yeah, behind the scenes and in front of the scenes.
It matters so much.
It does. It does. It really does. And doing this comic has put me in touch with a lot of amazing people like yourselves, and to talk about these types of things that we're all, like, you know, I feel like we're all the same age. I'm 29 years old. Growing up, I loved comics, but I never saw a Mexican character. I never saw, like, an overweight character, you know. So it was very important for me to kind of put what I want in this book to kind of give whoever sees this, they can hopefully see a little bit of themselves. Because I never got to have that as a kid.
For sure. Definitely.
And we're all about that. That's like, you know, if you don't see the space, create the space.
Right.
That's,
you know, comics, like, it's so underrated, like, what they're doing. And, you know, I'm hoping that this whole, like, superhero kick in film, like, you know, trickles down into this thing where also all these amazing diverse characters, like even America Chavez or Chavez. You know, even smaller characters that come up from Top Cow and Image. Like, I'm hoping that this stuff can also get greenlit to go into the big screen. Like,
right. It's just you know, it's funny because, like, the comic book industry has had an amazing Latinx or Hispanic at the time. You know, Latinx is a new word, but, like, the Hernandez brothers, you know, they made Love and Rockets, which is considered one of the best comics of all time if you actually make comics. And it's written by these, like, very reserved, you know, Latinx guys that are from California, you know, and it's about these, like, you know, my favorite characters who are, you know, they're bi because they love each other, but they also get into these terrible relationships with men, you know. So it's like, have you ever read Strangers in Paradise?
I haven't.
It's a really good series. It's like that, but it has that whole Jack Kirby, like, fantastic feel to it that you just can't really pin in one. It's a slice of life, but it has so much imagination to it, you know. So
gotta check that out.
Yeah, you get. So it's funny that, you know, we, as a person of color who's been reading comics and learning about comics, that people want, and I think everybody wants to see this experience of just brown people coming to their own. You know, this story is only 40 years old that I'm writing. Mm-hmm. It's not that old. I mean, people thankfully are alive to be able to recognize and help me tell an accurate portrayal of what happened. But it just, imagine if we even went a little further. You know, there's just so much history within Native American people and Hispanic people, especially southern of the southern part of the United States, that have all been robbed of their land and their culture. You know, I mean, you're from Texas, you know. You know how that went out there.
Yeah, so that happened to Latinos down there.
Yeah, everyone in like San Antonio, that culture is, it's just odd.
Yeah. My sister graduated from the Air Force, and I got to take I flew, and then I didn't have a car, and I love taking transportation, public transportation, so I went down to the Alamo, and I was like, I don't know what I was expecting, but I didn't expect to go into like a gift shop, which is what it is. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. You walk through, there's like a couple things in like glass boxes and
yeah.
It's a
gift shop. Yeah. And then there was this big monument, and these people asked me to take their picture. And I asked, what is this? And they said, this is where they piled all the bodies to burn. And then I said,
Texan.
Yeah. And then I said,
Texans.
And then I said, say cheese. And then they like, that was like their conversation. You know, this is where people were murdered and slaughtered, you know? Yeah.
It's a bit of a sick history that like Texans, I just vividly remember it, like in the public school education, how they romanticized the Alamo. Yeah. I'm like, this was a sick event.
It was on both sides. I don't know. I mean, the
definitely
way
that, at least on one.
Right.
Yeah, on one side.
Well, definitely both sides. Mm-hmm. I mean, what was interesting to me when I was researching about my history and my family, my mom is the great-granddaughter, or she's a granddaughter of my great-grandmother, Leonor Encinas, and she was born on Tucson land by Pascua people that came from Mexico. Mm-hmm. And the reason why they walked up or left Mexico was because the government waged war against them. You know, they were killing their people and they forced them out of Mexico. Mm-hmm. But they didn't know they were going into the United States.
Right.
You know, they were just going up north, finding a fertile ground and a cool spot in Tucson. Mm-hmm. Tucson's like below sea level, so it gets cold and it's extremely hot. It has both extremes. So learning about the history from 1815 all the way to 1856 to 1971 to 1969, actually, excuse me, to 1970 to 1976. It was just weird to me that the tribe never recognized the group that my great grandfather inspired, Mexican American Yaqui and others. Mm-hmm. They were like the political movement that helped the Yaqui people become recognized in the United States. Mm-hmm. And the Yaqui history books say they were driven out by the Mexican government. They found Tucson. Then in 1976, they were recognized. But what happened between?
Yeah, that's a lot of time. Yeah.
That's a big gap.
Yeah.
Right?
And it was, and learning about the Native American culture in general is that their history is oral. You know, everything's told verbally. And then they kind of, you know, I mean, within Old Pascua and New Pascua, they've lost their Yaman, I think I'm saying that correctly, their language. No one speaks their original language. If you go to the University of Arizona, I'm sure you can find a professor there that still knows it, but they've lost everything. I think that's because they never really documented everything. So that's why I'm kind of, and I also got in touch with the Yaqui tribe, asking them, why didn't you recognize these people? Why didn't you recognize their efforts? Because I have printed documentation that shows these people actually try to make a difference. Mm-hmm. And their response was, there was a lot of people that helped them, which was true. You know, the African American communities in Tucson that were in the outskirts of Tucson in the desert, you know, a lot of them came to be in the military. A post-World War II city where a lot of the African Americans were forced to be like completely outside of city limits, but they got a lot of land, but that still drove them away from, you know, just what any people were getting, kind of health care or public assistance, like food stamps. And there wasn't a lot of power or water out there. They had water wells and stuff.
So basic access to, like, necessities.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's what Mayo did. They helped the Yaqui people get sewage, because there was no sewage. They all had outhouses. They got running water, sidewalks, and streetlights installed. And Mayo also worked with this program called Model Cities that helped the people get public education, adult education, because a lot of the natives never graduated, or Mexicans, or people in that area, because it was a poor area, you know, poor space, and jobs, and low-income housing. So it was interesting to see this commitment to poor people that I don't see today.
You know? Definitely. Yeah. God, classism.
No. But I really like that you brought up something that's very true and something that we don't talk about, is like the indigenous Mexican relationship and how that anti-indigenous like thing is so real. Like, no one like talks about it, but when you go to Mexico, the way that like Mexicans treat other indigenous people, I mean, you're both indigenous, but the way they treat the people who openly embrace their indigenous ancestry, like, it's fucked up.
Yeah,
like, definitely. And they'll point it out, and I'm just like confused, because we all look the same. So it's like, wait, I'm sorry, hold up, what? They speak an extra language. That's it.
Yeah.
All of Mexico kind of has this, like, which is crazy because everybody now is very like, decolonize this.
Well, that's us on this side.
Right.
A few activists on that side.
Right. No, but what I'm saying is, like, now we have this movement, right, of anti-colonialism, but it's just like, we haven't dealt with like the fact of like stuff has happened, like, you know what I mean?
Culture.
Like, yeah. So I just it's really super interesting to hear about them, like how it was, you know, of course this is the Spanish influence that happened in Mexico that ended up with them pushing the Yaqui tribe out.
Yeah.
And it's trash.
It's trash.
Definitely.
And no one talks about it, and that's why I think it's so special.
But it's such an interesting thing to talk about, and that's why I'm so surprised that like in the indigenous like community is just not represented in the media, period. Even in comics, it's not
definitely
represented.
Yeah.
So you're bringing this in. You're bringing in everything that you're even talking about the Mayo helping out with like infrastructure and all that
stuff.
Yeah, basic access and necessities, and not just to you know, indigenous communities, but the Black communities, so everyone involved. That's
right. Beautiful. Yeah, there was a and they all came together to create something called the El Rio, which was a health clinic that's still thriving today. And they basically made low cost healthcare that their primary goal was to introduce contraceptive to the low-income people. You know, it was a new thing back then in the early 70s where people needed it, you know. It's funny because Margaret Sager, I think was her name, the woman who created abortion, she lived in Tucson, and she was considered a racist because she, it was the contraceptive, like birth control was used to curb people of color
to stop having
kids.
That's terrifying.
I never,
and I didn't know about that until there was like some sort of anniversary in her death. I was a journalist at the in Tucson. I worked for the Arizona Daily Star, and the editor in chief, I was the newsroom assistant. She asked me, can you please go into the archives and get this paperwork for me? And I'm sitting there, I'm reading this about this person. I had no idea, you know. And it was just how much we value it now, you know. And that's something that like the people are losing, was women especially in this current administration. But to be considered something that would stop people of color from having children, which was it just like blew my mind.
It's a terrible intent. That I mean, obviously contraceptives and abortion like should be, it's a right of a human, like
should be choice.
But like to have that history, but I mean, to be honest, America has like a bad history with freaking
literally
everything.
There's not a time when I can go back and go, that was a great time to exist. Yeah,
there is no making it great again.
No.
I promise.
Nothing great about the past in American history.
But that's like, that's a
distinct. I didn't know that. That's like, just so interesting. Like,
Yeah, it's
and radical. I love that you're like taking the time to tell these stories, because like I wish a bitch would have been taught this in like history class. Like, please tell me this information, because like no one else is gonna write about it. We have to write our stories about art, and you're writing about your family. Like, how much more? Like,
it's nerve wracking. Because I'm afraid of what my family's gonna think. They're very protective. It's weird. They did not really care much or talk to my great grandfather while he was alive, but they were very protective of his legacy. And that's interesting. Yeah, and to me, I wanted to preserve it. I wanted to make sure that, because I had questions when I was a kid, and the answers they gave me weren't sufficient. Mm. So I hope if someone like me is born into my bloodline and they want to know about their past, someone can just give them this book and say, here's what
it is.
Yeah.
So you're like going super like factual with this book, or are you taking liberties?
I'm taking liberties because I wasn't there, and as a journalist, I want to put in the events. Mm-hmm. So the events, the accomplishments are real.
Gotcha.
But it's like, you know, it's like Steven Spielberg's Abraham Lincoln movie. Mm-hmm. You know, like, there's just no way.
Yeah, nobody was there. Nobody could document that.
Yeah, yeah, so it also plays to, I hate biographies that make characters angels. You know, I went to see Straight Outta Compton. I love that movie. It's a great, beautifully shot. But like all the characters except for Eazy-E, who's dead, were angels.
Yeah.
They were like visionaries and badasses, but in real life they weren't angels.
No.
They beat women.
Yeah.
And the women who were a part of their history were cut out.
God.
And
yeah, that reporter, that was intense.
Yeah, and I was like, this sucks, you know? And then when I saw Dunkirk, I was sitting in, you know, 70mm, beautiful movie. I'm like, there is no way.
Did you watch it at Universal?
No.
Oh, okay.
I actually went home in Tucson, my favorite theater, the Loft Cinema. I was there. I saw it with my friend Astrid, who was very instrumental in helping me with my comic. I'm sitting there, I'm watching this movie. I'm like, there is no way all these white guys did this.
Yeah. Facts. I feel that.
And then, like, a couple days later, NPR did a story about how there was Muslim soldiers. And the one way they can prove that was because the British army or the French army had dietary restrictions for the Muslim people.
Oh, wow.
So they had to send them, you know, their food.
Could you imagine, like, if they hadn't had that proof? You know what I mean?
They would have just been like, well, there's no proof. They weren't there. It was all white people.
Yeah,
white
just people. All these French people, which was, you know, it's a beautiful movie, but I was just like, there's just no way that it was just, there was not a single brown person helping these people.
We were looking, when I watched the movie, I was like, there's like 100 extras, like, and I don't, what? This doesn't make sense. I saw like 2 black guys. And I was like, is this a group of, what? No, honey. Colonization
happened
everywhere.
So. Right. So has any of your family read the draft?
No, they all think I gave up on it.
Really?
Because it's been 3 years. You know? Wow.
They don't not even with social media, they're not
well,
even.
Well, they have a couple of cousins who kicked in, which is really nice of them.
Nice.
And, you know, if without them, they did a lot of research. They went to they had a lot of newspaper clippings.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom was very helpful in getting some documents for me, too. So I'm very privileged to have met my great grandfather. A lot of people don't have that opportunity to meet their greats, and have, you know, my family help with documentation, and my sister giving me one of the largest donations for the Kickstarter. So it's an interesting platform to see who gives you money, you know, because you could see to the dollar where you're getting the money. There was 310 people that gave, and about 100 of them were friends of mine that don't actually read comics.
Wow.
So they unknowingly
just want to support you.
Yeah, are supporting me, and they're unknowingly like doing something that they're helping me in a way that's going to help me in so many different ways in my industry. So I'm very grateful for the support, you know, especially from you for writing about it, and that Facebook group that I think you're a part of, Latinx Comics. Did you see that?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. This girl named Kat, who lives in Brooklyn, put it together. Amazing comic book creator who has opened a door for all of us to kind of get together and tell, tell each other what's happening, you know. So very grateful for all that.
That's amazing. Yeah, I don't think 100 of my friends listen to this podcast.
Well, I've been doing, yeah. I've been making comics for 10 years. Like, mm-hmm. so it's like,
how did you get into it? Actually, yeah.
let's when I was a kid, that. Like, or making yeah. comics. In
both. Like, both. How did you, what inspired you there?
When you were little.
When yeah. I was a kid, my parents would give me comics.
That's wild. Yeah, my yeah. parents were like, not going to buy me nothing.
Well, my parents were, they loved thrifting and reselling stuff at the swap meet.
Oh, you would love Luis, the guy that works out of here.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
This is his podcast. Like, I got to listen to it. Yeah. I spent my weekends, my sister and I would spend our weekends as a kid going to the swap meet Friday afternoon. We're there till like 10 or 11 o'clock until they close the doors. Like my mom and dad would just wait till everyone was there. And you just hear like crazy Tejano music and it's dark. It's like we were just saying, it's like Blade Runner, but but with like crap everywhere. And there was a little theater yeah. next to us, and they would just play Disney movies without permission.
That's
so
lit.
So you would just like go watch the newest Disney movie that came out on VHS. It was all scratchy and the sound yeah. was crappy. And there were just a bunch of kids who either spoke English or Spanish, and you're just kind of like rogue, you know, while your parents are trying to make hundreds of dollars. And then when we got older, we would have our own little table and sell stuff.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
And so they would have to go to yard sales to buy stuff, and I'm from a to resell. So I'm from a college town, and a lot of the kids that would leave town, the parents wouldn't know what to do with these boxes of comics. So my parents would get it for a deal, and they'd give me this box full of Batman, Robin, Wonder Woman, you know, Image.
That's so cool.
To start off like that, right?
Yeah. Like just classics. Here you go. Like, it's cheap, you know?
And paper, too. I started on digital comics.
Really? Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah, so I just had all these old school comics, and no one in my house. I would put them everywhere so people can try to read them, and no one would ever read. They would just end up back in my room, and I'd be really sad. And then
just leave it around.
And then, like, in the living room, the bathroom. I used to read comics in the bathroom. I mean, that's all. And I just loved the stories and the art and the emotions. You know, I learned a lot about, you know, racism and the crowded prison systems, you know, just
so
a lot
underrated.
Of justice.
Lit.
Yeah.
Like,
through Spider-Man comics. And that's all I wanted to do. I used to doodle my own stories. And then I would read these journalism magazines, the Comics Journal and Wizard. So I was just so invested in comics, and I didn't care about school. Like, that was just like secondary to me. I could write and read, but I couldn't do math because I just wouldn't like put the time in. And then when I turned 19 years old, I published this comic called El Loco. He was a superhero who was a migrant farm worker who was working the farms, and while like the pesticides are flying over, lightning and rain struck, and he gets superpowers, and he fights the chupacabra and racial profiling.
Oh my what? God,
this is, how old are you? That's
I'm 29.
No, when you wrote that?
Oh, I was like 19. Oh, so it was like God. 10 years ago.
That sounds really cool, actually.
I was like, wait, what? That's
yes.
like everything I ever wanted. Like,
but the end of it, first issue was he was fighting the chupacabra, and ICE busts him and arrests him because they think he's Mexican.
God.
Or like an immigrant. And then it was big at the time because SB 1070 was introduced by Governor Jan Brewer. Mm. And so like all the news outlets were like, and here's a superhero that's fighting Jan Brewer, you know, and it was just fun in that moment. And no comic book publisher would pick it up. You know, they just were too afraid.
Yeah. Especially because honestly, they're not going to pick the stuff up until times like now where diversity is like selling.
It's being demanded. Right. It's not just like.
Right.
So it'd be so interesting to see the stuff that you worked on before thriving now, you know what I mean? Which is the opportunity, obviously.
Yeah, and it was disheartening because you're just like, I have this good idea that's on the news, and then they say no, and you're like, okay, fine, I'll do something else. So then my best friend, who I made comics with, his name is Christian Belair, and we made this comic for a Morrissey anthology. So you had to like pick a song and do a story based on the Smiths songs.
That's really interesting.
That's really cool.
So we just picked a random song, but we did a story that had nothing to do with their song. It was just at the time Morrissey said that KFC was responsible for more deaths than Hitler and the Holocaust.
We're talking about animals.
Because of animals, yeah. So like KFC's worse than that. And then I was just like, this has to go into the comic, you know?
Yeah.
So we made this, it's called, meat is murder. we did a story about how there's a restaurant and you can bring your animal to slaughter however you want. So you could do like electric chair, firing Damn. Squad. And it's my friend likes to draw us in our comics. And I bring a chicken and then Morrissey kicks the door in and kills all the humans and frees all the animals.
Wow.
And
God. I love this.
I'll send you the files like so you can see that's funny. And it was kickstarted. It was picked up by BBC, like they did like a story on it. But since all of the stories were so like avant-garde and artsy, they didn't know how to describe it. So the only story they knew how to distill was like Punisher Morrissey, who was hated humans. So our story was the one that was always mentioned. And we then created another, me and Christian created another comic called Captain Unicorn. It's about a mystical man horse that kills bigots. And he was openly gay. It was like Freddie Mercury and Anderson Cooper who like created this. It was like wow. if they came together, made a kid, and made this man horse superhero who had like hooves for hands. It was basically Batman and Robin, but the gayer version of that.
That one I want to read.
I respect that you're like the gayer version of that.
That's what, yeah, because
it is
it's there.
I love Batman. Batman's my favorite character. Same. You know, and Absolutely. It's funny that, like, this guy who's just so, like, he gets girlfriends, but then he leaves them at the door just so he can hang out with Alfred and Robin, you know, and pummel, like, just beat people to a pulp. So we did that, and we did 40-plus pages of that comic. It was a lot of fun. There's a lot of, like, cum jokes in it and stuff. It's just this, like, really crude, heavy metal style comic. And not a single publisher would touch it. Strange, but it was inspired. It was just inspired. It was when Haiti had that big earthquake 10 years ago. Mm. Anderson Cooper was like on the scene. He's talking to the camera, and all of a sudden, this guy's on this like on this building chucking bricks at people. Dang. And this brick hits this little kid, and then Anderson Cooper just transforms and lifts this child, and there's blood all over him, and this kid is just like unconscious and. He just becomes this hero. And I was like, that's Captain America. That's the guy I want to see in a
so
comic.
Lit. Like
Anderson Cooper Prime, man. Like, right? Wild.
And then I quit comics to be a journalist. I worked for Arizona Daily Star. But I would always write about Free Comic Book Day and like comic book events. I worked for the Tucson Comic Con for 4 years. They just celebrated their 11th anniversary. And then I wrote about comics for free for comicsbeat.com. Heidi McDonald was the one who allowed me to write for her and her website that got me the job as a journalist in Tucson. So I was always like going to comic book conventions, keeping in contact because I knew at some point I'd want to go back into making comics. And then I worked for Frank Bedore. He's a novelist who self-publishes. And then I ended up getting a job at Top Cow Productions just as an operations coordinator. And I've become their social media person, their PR person, their retail outreach. Also now pivoting more into libraries, kind of trying to get more libraries hip with Top Cow Image Comics. So that's been a big thing for me in 2018. And then at night, just writing comics that I want to publish.
Wow,
that's so amazing. That's so inspiring. Like you're just like, if I don't see it, I'm gonna do it.
That's the story of a lot of people.
Everyone like, we meet, it's like, and that's like the story of any like creative, any person that's just out here doing it. They just don't see it and they create it.
Yeah,
and they love that.
Yeah, that's
amazing. Always talking about those kind of same superheroes. That's why I'm like, oh my god, yes. That's
yeah, super cool. I mean,
we're always talking about like America, like you know,
America is my favorite. Yeah.
Punching Nazis, like that's lit. Jeez. Oh,
it's
God.
Good shit. Well, let's talk about representation a little bit.
Let's
that's,
do it. Yeah.
Obviously, you're here and you're providing this representation. So all of you guys, check this out. We'll link it wherever we can. Actually, while we're on that topic, before we move on, what's the news on the comic? Is there like a date for release?
So, the comic is basically Kickstarter exclusive at the moment. You know. We're going to do a digital release, send it to all our backers, and then we are going to do a small print run that will fulfill all the orders. And then whatever we have left, I'm going to sell myself. And then the hopes is to put it digitally, you know, across all boards, do a first issue, then a second chapter and a third chapter, and then it will only hit print for the masses when it's completely put together
when it's a volume.
When it's a full graphic novel. The comic book industry right now, it's in a weird transition. I think it has a lot to do with the economy, basically, a lot to do with the publishers themselves. You know, they're really catering to variant happy comics. So, like, they'll give retailers the option to buy one cover or more covers of a second cover, or they will say, if you buy 100 copies, you get this rare copy of this variant, which, so then that ups orders for retailers, and they'll have to then look at stuck with books, or if there's an option to get a, you know, their money back. But I'm not relatively known in the retail comic book industry, so it would be a losing financial cause for me and for the publisher to do it as a monthly comic. So if I did it as a graphic novel, which is cheaper to print and also more inviting to libraries, bookstores, something that everyone can carry, and make it in an affordable way that you didn't have to pay $5 for each issue. You're only getting it for like $15 to $20. So we're hoping to have it solicited and available in July in time for the San Diego Comic Con.
Cool. Okay. Good to know. Yeah. Good to know.
That's not too long from now when you really think about it. That's
good. Time flies.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the other things is you just want to have it all done and ready, you know, and you don't want to be under the pressure of a monthly schedule. You know, I'd be more than happy to do monthly scheduled work, but if I can choose, I'd rather choose a more profitable way that makes my publisher more inclined to do this again with me.
Yeah, and just sustainability, you know.
Right.
Like, for sure.
You gotta eat.
So representation.
Yes.
I want to know when the first time you saw yourself represented was, when whatever medium it was.
Actually, film, you know, thanks to, and my parents loved to laugh. They were big comedians, so we were big fans of George Lopez and Cheech Marin, you know. I loved, I think Coming to America or like Born in East LA,
yeah,
like the Cheech Marin movie was one of those, like, funny, like, this guy speaks, like, my parents didn't teach me Spanish, they didn't want me to speak Spanglish or broken English, so seeing Cheech Marin have this, you know, very articulate way of speaking, but also having that, like, Chicano slant because he's from East LA, that was one big thing. I never saw it in comics. I still haven't, I don't think. I really still, other than like Love and Rockets, but it's still, like, you know, it's more to the women, you know. I would have to say comedy and film was what I saw myself and my, what I can relate to. But for, I always, sure, see this, like, weird stereotype of it, you know, the chancla, like, there's that crap. I hate the chancla. It's so annoying to me. But, like, it makes people laugh. And I can see why it's successful and it's why it's constantly used. But to me, it's just, like, overdone.
Definitely. I think, like, as a concept, it was just... It was weird because you grow up with it or whatever, like, this whole chancla thing.
Yeah.
But until you get older and you become an adult and it becomes a concept of, like... We were really threatened by a shoe.
Or whatever was lying around. Bell,
right, or a belt was anything. A lot of the time. And then, so I think it just kind of becomes comedic at that point. Yeah, but yeah. I mean, a lot of things are overdone. Our own fucking, like, show name, Coronas y Chingonas, that shit's overdone.
Really?
I would say it's getting to that point.
Well, where, like, okay, so everyone, you know, calls themselves, like, a chingona and everything.
Right.
Cabrona, people don't really use that one.
They don't use cabrona. Don't use cabrona.
Yeah. I don't know why. I thought they were the same as far as... It's fine.
But either way, you know, like conchas, you know what I mean? Like, all this stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So I completely feel that.
Yeah, in comics, it's still... I don't think I've ever seen it still to this day.
Yeah.
For sure.
Maybe it's out there. Maybe, you know, that's why I made a loco, you know. And then I always see white people stealing lucha libre, you know.
God.
Like, luchadores are always being put in the same way. They basically saw Santos movies and they're like, let's carbon copy that into our own stuff.
Yeah. Have you seen Border or her? Red Border Town.
Yeah. So I'm from Tucson. That's where Eric Esquivel is from, and we both grew up together. Like I'm a little bit younger than him. He used to work at Heroes and Villains, where I would sometimes get my comics, and he and I were always. Like, he's Superman, I'm Batman. So there's this, like, we're friends, but, like, we both butted heads sometimes, and we would work together, and there's just, like, there wasn't a lot of people making comics. And now we're, like, better friends than we've ever been. And I actually drove him to San Diego Comic-Con once, and we met Matt Fraction, and we had come up together, and sometimes we're synonymous. But now more so because he's working at Vertigo and I'm working at Top Cow.
For sure.
But Border Towns is so good, it makes me mad.
But, you know, I don't know about you, but for me, like, spite drives me a lot of the time. So I feel like if somebody, like, that I came up with was doing something really good, it would just make me want to do something really fucking good.
He actually hired me to do his Fantagoria.
It's Fangoria.
Fangoria, yeah. I lettered that book for him.
Oh, that's really
and
that's
he got me the gig. And, you know, I got him a gig doing Girl Scout comics. And we both have always helped each other out. And we're both really good friends. I was on his podcast. And Border Town's such a good comic because it doesn't make fun of itself. And it's... I know Eric, so I know everything that's in that book because I know how much of himself he's putting in it. Mm. And it's incredible. It's ballsy as hell. It's that's really dope. Yeah, it's so, I mean, you know, you got the whole Mexican Superman luchador kid who's just like an introvert, but he's like threatening as hell. You got the like Asian chick and who's Japanese and Mexican, which I saw in Tucson when at the swap meet, there was this little Chinese guy or Asian guy. He knew fluent Spanish and would make fun of me because I was Mexican and I didn't know Spanish.
Well, one of my, I took some Spanish courses just because I fucking knew that my Spanish was trash and I didn't want to be that person. So I took some courses in college and one of my teachers was an Asian man. Wow. And I was just like, oh, he's better than I am. God.
I never had anyone like, and my Spanish is trash and like. I would sleep through those classes, wake up, talk, and they'd leave me alone. Like, they were like, oh, yeah, Cynthia, what are you going to do? I've never experienced that.
It was great. Yeah. I was like, this is great.
Yeah, you got to actually learn.
Yeah, no, I wanted to. I know how to speak Spanish fluently, but, like, I didn't know the history. I didn't know how to write it properly. Mm. You know what I mean? So I went and I fine-tuned myself a little.
Right, yeah. Right. No, it sucks. It sucks. Shout out to them. Mm-hmm. It sucks that I don't know how to speak it or write it. Because when I was a journalist, they were like, you know, if you knew how to speak Spanish and write in Spanish, you could double your output and make more money. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, shut up. I don't know. But no, I'm really proud of Border Town, Ramon Villalobos, and their colorists. I think Tamara is her name. They're doing such a good book, and a lot of people love it. It's being so well received. And Eric was just on Word Balloon Podcast, which is like a college dissertation podcast for comics. He talked about hope, and his hope was that hopefully Border Town shakes up
the space.
Yeah it shakes up the publishers and makes them realize that a comic about Latinx characters, culture, story will help inspire more
stories. Yes. Ugh. Exactly. Yeah. Like the Brokeback Mountain effect, the Coco effect. Yes, you know what I mean? Like effects. These things need to open up space for people like you.
Yeah.
To like one up the next one and then you one up it.
And then you
one up
keep
it.
Telling these incredible stories. Like, yeah. I don't know about this.
There are wild good stories out there for people of color to tell.
Wasn't like Lady Bird or Lady like that.
Real Women Have Curves.
Yeah,
we talked about it a little bit. Yeah, it's a very similar story.
Although, you know.
She doesn't think it was a ripoff.
Problematically, I like Lady Bird, and I think all stories are kind of...
I think they were both great.
Yeah, they are.
I think they're both great, and I think it took a lot of work to make both of those. One of them obviously hit more personally
right. Real
to
Women
my
Have
life,
Curves had
but,
a certain
know.
Nuance.
But yet both of them I could relate to very much, so...
Yeah, that's kind of the reason why I'm reluctant to see Mid-90s. Have you seen...
Oh, really? I haven't seen it.
I was there.
What is that? What is
it's
that ripoff?
It's Jonah Hill, mm-hmm. and it's basically... His movie is basically like, remember when we used to say fag and it was funny?
God.
Like, that's kind of how it feels, but I don't know. I haven't seen a preview for it, but I heard his NPR...
With Terry Gross.
Yeah, where he was kind of really trying to defending like the language in it. And I want to see it because it sounds like a good movie, but I was there, you know, and I don't really need to see how terrible I used to be on the big screen. You know, because when you're a kid, you just want to...
You just do what everybody else does.
Fit in and say... And I think you all touched upon that, too. Like, there was, like, a episode where you're talking about how, like, everyone learns, you know, we're not all perfect people.
I always talk about it.
I was homophobic.
Oh, so
I am gay.
Yeah.
Like... Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't get any worse than that.
Yeah, my mom used to say, like, if you come home gay or if you turn gay, I'll teach you how to swim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my mom would just be like, that's not my kid anymore if that kid's gay. And I was just like, dude, like, okay, this is how we feel? All right.
I think I was just made jokes until I was like, oh, wait, that's me. Why am I making fun of myself now? Like, I'd be like, I'm only gay for myself. And I was like... Deep down, I was like, no, I'm not.
You know, and homophobia for me was fear of my life. You know, it was just like, if I became gay, like, you could do that? You could become gay? So I would just, it was like, I was afraid of gay people, you know, like, because what kind of, like, how could you live like that? And that was, and my uncle, who's now a trans woman, was ostracized, you know, and that... Always, that's why I always wanted to write about gay characters, because I was like, I never got to know her, and then I was like, I have to be an ally, you know, I have to learn about these people and go into the community. And I made a radio show called Out Loud and Proud for the radio station I used to work for. So I had talked to a lesbian woman, two trans women, two gay men, and I think she was bisexual. No, she was lesbian. And I recorded their coming out stories, and we broadcast them on the radio.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. That's great. I mean, that's true allyship to me, is like, you put their voice out there. You don't impose yours. You put their voice out
there. Create a space for other people.
Right.
Right. And the whole intention was to bring people into the radio station, see how easy it was to use the facility because it's nonprofit and community run, showing them that, like, this is a cool place to be, like, come here and do more work for us and tell your story. So I'm still always a student of being an ally for, you know, the LGBTQ IA community.
That's dope.
It's called growth.
It's like, called
all
growth.
All three of us grew.
For sure. I've had a lot of straight people tell me that they really like mid-90s. I haven't heard the voice from anybody else.
That's
probably
why we should go see it, because we need to.
You think so? Maybe. I want to watch it. I just thought it was a decent trailer.
Yeah. No, it looks cool. I just, when I heard the interview, I was like, oh, yeah, I already lived through all that.
You're like, I was.
For sure. Well, since you mentioned it, I have to ask, will you be having any LGBTQ themes in your comic?
In Tata Rambo? I have some characters that in the original pitch, in the original story, there was a gay character, but I felt like I was forcing him in there. So I kind of backed out of that. In the third, actually, you're right. Yeah, there is. So where I went, so 3 years ago when I made the Out Loud and Proud program, this is work at that time I was making the story, or I was trying to figure it out. So in issue two, it opens with, so like the first issue opens with me with Tata Rambo, and then the second chapter issue opens with me doing stand-up on one page, and on the other page, it's me recording my friend's coming out story.
Okay.
But it's in the same way, like it's like me on stage doing jokes about myself, and then on the second page, it's her coming out to her classroom. So it's like us opening in different ways. Mm-hmm. So
that's cool.
Yeah, there is her coming out story coming. It's in that page. So yeah, there is the theme, but I would like to incorporate a gay character. I'm thinking the antagonist might be gay, but I don't. That might be a stretch. Who knows? Because I like, yeah, and I don't want that. You know, him being the gay character, being the bad guy, but he's also not really a bad guy. He's just the funding, the freeway, but I think he's just going to be this monster person that has no people connections. He just wants to be successful, but I'm not going to try to force it. but definitely that, have that's a theme.
Important.
I prefer that. Thank
yeah.
you.
That,
thank
that's
you
for that's that. That's very important it, because they're yeah. You know, it's not like
token. Right.
It's not like every gay character being, or like an antagonist character being gay is always wrong. Mm. You can do these things right. There's you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, look at Claws. Yeah. Claws did it really interestingly, where the basically a drug kingpin or whatever, like he was just really like casually bisexual.
Right.
And they Claws. Yeah. I think that there's a right way to do it. You just have to do it, like you said, naturally.
Yeah.
You can't make it like gay bad. No, like this isn't some Scar and Lion King thing. Like,
oh, man. Yeah. So my goal is to tell a compelling story with logical steps to it.
That's great.
There's there might be some representation of LGBTQIA within the community. Help, hopefully, for sure. You know, we'll see. But it is early 70s, so a lot of that in Arizona wasn't really prevalent. You know, in San Francisco, definitely. So we'll see. Hopefully, but I know I have other stories that I want to tell that definitely portrays diverse characters that aren't stereotypical at all. So,
well, I can't wait to read them.
Hype on that, because for sure everything you said, I'm like, yes, I always wanted to read that. Yes, give me that now.
That's great.
Thank you
for sure. Well, thank you so much for being here. Let us know, let our listeners know, where can we find you, where can we support you? We're going to be posting the Kickstarter link for sure.
Oh, thank you. You can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram under my name, Henry Barajas or Henry J. Barajas. You can find the Kickstarter on Kickstarter. It's called La Voz de Mayo, the voice of Mexican American Yaqui and others. Tata Rambo. We're hoping. I don't know how we're going to sell it digitally, but it has to be available digitally at some point. So
Comixology.
Yeah. The thing with Image and Top Cow is that like if you put something through them, it has to go through everything. Mm-hmm. It has to go through like Google Play, iTunes and like all their digital services. They can't just like favor one.
Right.
If I can do it on my own, I will, but I don't want to step on my publisher's shoes or toes. Oh. So it will, I mean, you could buy it from me and I'll send you a PDF link, or if you PayPal me or Venmo. we'll see. But yeah, find me. I'm everywhere saying dumb crap.
No, I guess a question I meant to ask earlier, but where did that name come from for Abuelo?
So when I was a kid, they used to call him Tata Rambo, and it was to make fun of him.
Really?
Oh, wow.
Even though he was a World War II Marine sniper, they'd be like, that's Tata Rambo. Mm-hmm. And that's what I called him.
It was like a joke.
And like when I told my uncle, Ralph, I said, I'm going to call it Tata Rambo. He said, don't call it that. And I was like, why not? He goes, because your cousins used to call him that to make fun of him. Mm-hmm. And I was like, but I never thought of it that way. I thought that was cool.
Badass. I thought that was cool. I was like, whoa.
So I wanted to reclaim it for me because it's my book and do a portrayal for him in a positive light.
I think that's totally fair. I think a lot of people take back their bullying names. Look at Tiffany Haddish. She calls herself the last black unicorn. And they used to bully her with that name.
Yeah, they used to call me coconut when I was a kid. Brown on the outside.
White on the inside.
Yeah.
I still get called like whitewashed to this day.
I just get called white.
But I mean, but you're light skinned, so
we're the same color.
You are. You're pretty same. Yeah, you're pretty same.
I get knocked
okay,
for
but when
it.
When I was little, up until I was like maybe 18,
but not
I was
now.
Brown and beautiful, and now I'm light skinned. It's weird. It's really weird.
Let the record show that I might am the same color as fried puppy.
Oh no! Don't say that. I mean, they can see it, obviously.
Yeah. So yeah, you can find me wherever. Yeah, I'll be online.
We will link him on cabronasychingonas.com as well, as always.
Thank you.
And thank you guys for listening. Follow us at CUIC Podcast. Rate and review. Follow Henry.
5 stars and follow Henry.
And buy his stuff and help his Kickstarter.
Give him money. Let's put money where it should go.
Yeah, and also give money to your Patreon.
Support us on Patreon, guys. We're there always giving extra content once a month at least.
Yes. And you can start at $1 and you can go up to 3 and get an episode every one episode a month
or so.
Extra.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being here once again.
We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And thank you, everyone, for listening.
Bye.
Bye.